Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, May 24th. Today we're broadcasting live from Hilo. We're at Hilo Medical Center to talk about what a $50 million gift from Salesforce billionaire Mark Benioff will do to improve healthcare. We take a hard look at the state of Hilo's sewage treatment plan. It is one of the worst in the country. And finally, some relief for boaters. Work to dredge harbors on the east side is about to begin. And we recently got an earful on the efforts to prevent Nene from getting toxoplasmosis from feral cats. So we're hearing another side of the issue. And we get to know a math teacher from Waikea High School, one of the top teachers in the state. Plus, his students weigh in on what makes a good teacher. The conversation starts right after national and local headlines. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. We are broadcasting from the Big Island. We are live from Hilo Medical Center, where a generous $50 million donation from Mark Benioff and his wife Lynn will help speed up the expansion of the facility. This morning, hospital spokeswoman Elena Kabatu joins us live to give us an update. Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, this gift, it's really, this is one of those very impactful things, really, yeah.
You know, as a state entity, we don't see this kind of donation come in, and we couldn't be more grateful for this transformative gift from Mark and Lynn Benioff.
And so tell us, so we got $50 million for this house, for the medical center, from lawmakers the year before.
Oh, right? Yes. We worked very hard to raise awareness on the needs of our hospital with the capacity issues during the pandemic and then beyond, and they heard us, and we're so grateful that they responded so beautifully and awarded the $50 million to our hospital.
Right, but that wasn't going to really, you know,
that wasn't going to cut it.
Cover
right,
everything.
Yeah. The total expansion costs $80 million, so we can get a new 19-bed ICU and 36 additional hospital beds on the third floor.
And, you know, if I recall, there was an incident where this point was really driven home about the need to upgrade facilities. You had a conference, and I believe it was Dan Okaka Jr., right, who had a medical issue.
Yes, you know, we were all in that room at that summit, and he did. He was doing opening protocol, and, you know, we were all so concerned. He got to the mic and, you know, unfortunately collapsed, but in a sense, fortunately, he was there with all of the medical professionals, and you know, the fire department and the medics came promptly, and then we were all witness to what the medical system looks like on the Big Island.
Yeah, and there was a lot of waiting around to get him over to Honolulu, but this was a story that Benioff mentioned at the groundbreaking in Honolulu, and that just was very touching because you just know that the need is great here on the neighbor islands.
Very great.
And so tell us, so you've got the expansion of the ICU, and this will really allow you to open those facilities and expand those facilities sooner.
Well, yes, the funding will let us, will allow us to open this facility, and it's under construction. We're underway. We are very proud of doing, the way we do business is we have these projects that are shovel ready. And so when the money comes, we're ready to go, and Hilo will get its expansion of our hospital sooner rather than later, and we're so grateful.
Yeah, we can hear the heavy equipment moving things out there as we were walking through this morning. Yeah, it's really bustling with activity.
Oh, yes, bustling very much so on both sides of the street, and we have, you know, one lane closed in the mornings throughout the day, and it's just a huge sign of progress, and we mahalo the community for their understanding of what progress looks like and ask them to come a little bit earlier for their appointments or to see loved ones. It's definitely progress underway.
And, you know, when we talked many times during the pandemic, I recall, you know, just a concern we all had because there was an outbreak at our a veterans home here, the Okutsu home, right?
Yeah.
And you folks ended up taking over that facility.
Yes, we welcomed them under our wings, and they are still going through through recovering from that tragedy, and we are just rebuilding from it. And so, we have great leadership there, great staff that are dedicated to our veterans, and we look forward to turning the corner and getting things back to, business as normal.
Yeah, I mean, I recall those conversations that we had because you didn't know if you were going to have enough beds to cover everybody, if you had really serious COVID cases.
Oh, yeah.
And then, the concern for the veterans there in the home who came down during the pandemic, with the illness. And of course, they were, they're elderly and just more
These
fragile.
Are kupuna, It was very well known that, one of them was a relative one of our dear nurses. And so, we didn't just look at them as veterans. We looked at them as kupuna, and, our hearts went out to them. So when they came over to our facility, and we just tried our very best to care for them.
And then you do have a number of long-term care beds.
Oh, yes.
As well,
yeah.
And other areas.
Other areas. One right next door, our extended care facility has been there for decades. We have a facility in Honoka, and then also another facility in Kau. So we cover a lot of the East Hawaii region for long-term care.
Well, I recall many years ago, the head of the healthcare association at the time had said, boy, I sure hope that, if you're there on the Big Island, that you don't break any bones, because at the time, I think you were lacking an orthopedic surgeon.
I remember that day, that situation in which we had, our one orthopedic surgeon at the time was off island, and we had to inform our staff that, let's pull together because we had no coverage. And, I'm happy to say today that that's not the case. We have expanded our orthopedic surgery line and services, and we can handle cases that come to us, whether they're traumas or, broken bones from a fall.
Yeah, well, I just recall thinking, wow, that just never occurred to me that you would have to then, wait for a flight out to Honolulu to get treatment because there was no a physician here that could deal with that.
Very unfortunate times. And, we had been working since then to get to where we are today to care for our community when they need us.
And, I know the governor has talked a lot about the need to really improve medical care in the rural areas, because he has his connections here and, with the Kona Hospital. And he saw it firsthand.
He did. If there's someone who truly knows what the situation is on the Big Island and neighbor islands, it's our governor. And he spent a lot of time, too, in our Kau Hospital.
And so tell us, what's next on the horizon as far as the work that's underway here on campus?
Well, on campus, we're looking at two to two and a half years of progress. And so we are going to expand the hospital. We still have capacity issues. It's ongoing. We have our community has grown tremendously, even leading up to the pandemic, through the pandemic, and even into today. So we as a hospital have had to respond, grow services to support the needs of our growing community.
And some of this money will go toward helping physicians, right, to attract physicians here?
Oh, absolutely. In addition to the donation to the governor's help program, to recruit physicians to our community, we are growing behavioral health services, our neuroscience program, and we're just looking forward to this money being extremely productive and beneficial for our community.
And you also have plans for expansion of the birthing center.
Oh, yes. A $15 million birthing center will be built and will be very good for mothers and babies and families.
So what's the time frame? What can you share with our listeners?
Oh, the time frame. Well, let's just get through this first 2.5 years of this expansion of our hospital. And then from then than on. I mean, things are in play and underway, but we'll get to the next parts of our expansion of our services after this hospital expansion.
Yep. Okay, mm-hmm. All right. But otherwise, you've got to, I guess, just be mindful of the construction if you're coming to this area. Mm-hmm. And I guess we'll look forward to the grand reopening of the Benioff.
Yes, Hilo Benioff Medical Center.
Okay, there we go. All right. Thank you so much, Elena. We have been hearing from Hilo Medical Center spokeswoman Elena Kabatu about a $50 million gift from Big Island resident Mark Benioff.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Tadra Hamill, author of Therapy Chicken. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how the wisdom of the flock can bring you joy.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Mobi, a Hawaii wireless company serving the island since 2005, committed to providing personal service to each customer, featuring a locally based customer care team. Learn more at mobi.com.
The Environmental Protection Agency recently reached a consent decree with Hawaii County on its aging sewage system. It includes the Hilo treatment plant. Martha Guzman is the EPA Region 9 Administrator who was in the islands last week. We sat down with her to talk about the dismal state of the Hilo facility. She told us the only other plant in worse condition is one in California near the Mexico border. She also addressed the slow conversion from cesspools to septic tanks or hookups to the county sewage system.
You know, that system, it has the potential to serve the greater community. And so part of the vision is to get all of the households that are not yet connected to connect to the system. It'll provide for more revenue to maintain the system and, of course, take out of use all of those other cesspools. So that's a big one. And just as we saw in Lahaina, where you see pockets of communities that are not connected to sewer, you see that in Hilo as well, where the older communities, you know, we have more Native Hawaiians and, you know, have a demographic that is definitely should be connected.
Explain to our listeners the snapshot of where Hawaii is compared to the rest of the country when it comes to cesspools and sewer hookups.
Yeah, I mean, some of the geography of Hawaii is so unique where the lava formations just shoot the water straight into the ocean, you know, and then there's other areas where it does get into groundwater. And some of those areas are a bigger concern. But in areas, particularly like in the Big Island of Hawaii, where there's so much resource along the shorelines, so much coral and things that are greatly impacted by a lot of nutrients, that's an additional issue. And, you know, I think across the nation, there are certainly many facilities that are in need of investment. And the advantage that many of those areas have is that they have economies of scale. They have more people. They can finance it through their revenue base. So, you know, I think I mentioned to you earlier that, unfortunately, there's probably only one other system but that's competing with the most needed system of repair.
Okay, let's just say it's probably one of the worst in the country very bottom.
From my personal experience, mm-hmm. It's definitely one of the worst, yeah. It's short of not providing any treatment at all right now.
Wow, yeah. That's pretty bad.
Yeah, but the leadership is there now. The investment commitments are there. The state of Hawaii has made commitments from some of the federal funding as well. So that's why it was very exciting to actually get the commitments in writing and get past kind of the denial. This is kind of an ironic thing that I've seen throughout my visits here and talking to whether it's some of the kupuna with their views on cesspools or even some of the environmental groups that don't necessarily prioritize it. And it is this issue that has led to a little bit of denial about the problem, even though there is a state mandate that we got to phase them out. So, you know, we've been working in partnership with DOH. We take on the large cesspools, and they're trying to deal with a lot of this creativity. They're also doing some pilots across the islands to try to convert and help finance the conversion of cesspools to either very well-lined septics or to connect to the sewer, which is, you know, when there's an opportunity, like in places like Hilo, we want people to connect. There's other solutions, like some of the smaller towns on the eastern side of the island on Hawaii. You know, they don't have the capacity to manage a new wastewater system. So what we're looking at there is some well-managed septic systems, which is, it comes down to the operating and maintenance and how you can really support that. And so some of those options are lower cost. And that's what we've been able to work through with the County of Hawaii.
We hear lots of news about, you know, fines for the large capacity cesspool owners. Maybe people didn't realize they were large capacity. And so you're still moving with that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's a big part of our portfolio that we continue to invest in. We have people on island that really focus on that.
And then as far as then the upgrades to the wastewater system, I mean, you know, Mayor Roth has said, yeah, we don't want to see a, you know, catastrophic failure because, you know, they're going to be in a world of hurt if that happens.
Yeah, I think he's really, like I said, the part that's really extraordinary is that they're putting even some of their own general fund on the table, which is very hard. And he had to get a lot of support for that, obviously, with his leadership on the council. But they're there. They got it. They got it there. And we're just, now we're at a much more, kind of like how we're working in Maui now, where we're working on figuring out the funding. Because that's our other arm. We have our regulatory arm on the Clean Water Act, but we have the financing arm and really looking at all the federal funds that can be brought down to help with this, particularly right now with the bipartisan infrastructure law.
The feds just recently put a bunch of money toward dealing with lead. And, you know, we do have a lot of lead pipes in those schools.
Yeah. Then there was an augmentation also on the infrastructure side to look at things like fixtures. The very exciting thing with the lead funding that came for drinking water is that it can go into something that's restricted in the other areas. This funding can help fund the infrastructure to the home and even looking at what are those other sources, because oftentimes we stop, you know, with the main lines and the laterals are often difficult and then anything else that might be needed in the home. So the funding is really diverse and it really helps locals figure out, is it a fixture problem? Is it a pipeline problem? Most of the time it's not a source water problem unless you're in some of these mining communities in Arizona or something like that. Usually it's a pipeline problem. And, you know, it hasn't been a huge issue in the islands, except it's in some of these fixtures, which happens to be in schools, happens to be in homes. So the level of kind of investigation has to go deeper. You know, we had a whole team that was out at Saipan doing some work there that they found just a series of lead that had to be removed from fixtures. So it does really take a deeper look at where, more traditionally than our usual look at the well water, you know, and test that.
Well, I guess, you know, if you figure that, Lahaina Luna School is the oldest school right in the country, you know, what's the snapshot then for the other schools, you know, across the Big Island, right? You know, where you don't have the newer communities and the newer facilities.
Right.
So, anything else that you think would be important to underscore? You know, I know when it comes to, you know, sewage and converting to cesspools, from cesspools over to sewer or septic, it's that big nut to crack because, you know, you're talking, what, like $30,000, and that's, you know, here in Hawaii, that's just so hard to scrape up.
Yeah. You know, we've done so many incredible partnerships in the Big Island there, but you know, they've been a leader on the coral reef issues. They've hosted many international meetings where we've talked about all the different solutions and strategies, everything from, you know, the strategies around the sunblock and eliminating some of those risks to nutrient loading, which we're talking about here, but also from agriculture, you know.
Right, the fertilizer runoff, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and the manure, you know, similar issues. So they've always been a great leader in that. A couple of my times that I visited with some of the kupuna there as well on the Mauna Kea, and I know that that's picking up again with the NSF doing some more workshopping on that. And we've really enhanced our practice, as we were talking about earlier, with Lahaina around the importance of cultural knowledge and really incorporating that into all of our work. So we've been encouraging that with our federal partners as well. Of course, reinforcing the importance of that mauna to the Native Hawaiians. Most of the time, though, we're really focused on this cesspool issue in Hawaii. We've done a really very exciting project that we did with a group there on pollution prevention. They're starting small as a pilot, but we funded them for a larger scale dishwashing facility because what they want to do is get all of the retail restaurants to use the same sort of reusable takeout containers. The goal is zero waste, is to get away even from compostables because some of the compostables turns out have plastics. It's only possible to do something like that when you're in community and you can really convince a restaurant owner to take this on. It's a big shift from something that, you know, is whatever they're using today, right, which is probably plastics.
Yeah, but walk the talk.
We've been hearing from Martha Guzman, EPA Region 9 Administrator. She was talking to us about a number of environmental issues, including a consent decree that sets a timeline for needed repairs to the Big Island sewage treatment plants. This week, the State Department of Land and Natural Resources put a request for bids out to dredge Hilo's Wailoa Harbor. It hopes to begin work by June 17th to provide relief to boaters from the buildup of sediment that has made the harbor almost impassable at times. We talked to Finn McCall, an engineer with the Boating and Harbor Division, about the state of Big Island facilities, including Wailoa.
So at Wailoa, it's pretty dire. Most vessels cannot even get in and out of the harbor itself. Only the smaller vessels that have a lower draft, meaning how deep the boat goes in the water, only the smallest boats can really get out at high tide. And they have to time it so that they come back in at a high tide or else they get stuck.
That's really dicey, particularly if a lot of these boaters, you know, it's their livelihood.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why, you know, as soon as we got the funds released, you know, we moved straight ahead to get a consultant to, you know, prepare the plans and do the water depth surveys and all that stuff that you need to do for a maintenance dredging project.
And this has been exacerbated, I'm sure, with just all the bad weather we've had and the flooding.
Yeah, and that's always, you know, it's always a very fluid situation there. You know, sometimes we get sediment that builds up from the ocean side, and then we also get sediment that builds up from the river side. So it'd be pretty tricky.
And the boaters have been complaining about this for a long time, and you've been asking for additional funding to get this job done.
Yeah, we've been requesting for years because, you know, we know that the harbor needs to be dredged, you know, approximately every 7 to 10 years. Yeah, we've been putting in our requests. Unfortunately, you know, our most recent request occurred, you know, during COVID when funding revenues were really low, but we did finally get successful in getting the funding released this year, so we're happy to be able to move forward on the project.
And when was the last time it was dredged?
Last dredged in 2015.
I understand that this bad weather also affected your harbor over there on Kauai High.
Yes, we got a very heavy rain event that one of the streams that meanders around our access road, there was just so much volume of water that it reached over its own banks and washed away, you know, approximately 300-400 feet of our access road.
So what does that do for business over there?
Fortunately, there is an alternate access that folks can still access our South Smallboat Harbor through the DOT Coral Flats. So fortunately, yeah, there hasn't been any closures or, you know, any interruptions of the harbor itself. Unfortunately, our water mains that were underneath that access road got washed out also, so we don't have any water to the harbor right now.
What about repairs? How's that going to get fixed?
Yeah, we need to kind of redesign the roadway there. You know, it won't be just a matter of building it back up and laying down asphalt. We need to design a way to protect the road from future rain events like that. And we'll also need to seek funding from the legislature for this project because it may be a significant cost.
And the water situation, is there any way around that?
Yeah, we're going to work on installing like a bypass water line to bypass around where the road was washed out and restore water service. So we're hoping to get that done within the next month or two.
And then what can you tell us about the other harbor, down south? It was inundated by lava.
Yeah, so that's our Pohoiki boat ramp. It was inundated and filled in with lava debris in 2018. So we've been working on since then, trying to get funding for it, which fortunately we've gotten. We have approximately $6.6 million appropriated for the project. And right now we're working on getting our Army Corps permit to do the actual dredging work to reopen that harbor. So we're looking at trying to get that project out to bid by mid-June and hopefully start dredging by September, October.
Okay, and how long will that take to clear, you think?
We're estimating it's going to take about 6 to 9 months.
Wow, so it's still going to be a long haul for the sports fishermen, the recreational boaters, tour companies, that kind of thing?
Yeah, unfortunately, all of those folks, they've been really struggling for all these years because they have to go all the way to Hilo to get into the water. Pohoiki was the only boat ramp on that whole side of the island.
Okay, but there is some relief, but sadly, not fast enough.
Yeah,
they've been waiting a long time.
And it's a real tough situation, right? Because all the boaters that use Pohoiki have been using Wailoa, and now we have Wailoa shoaled in that needs dredging. So it just really exacerbates everything.
Well, how are you going to maneuver the dredging when you have all these boats?
Well, so dredging is usually done from a barge, and on the barge, you have an excavator. So what we're planning to do is dredge out the area that's shoaled in the channel that's blocking people from getting in and out. So during that time, boats won't be able to get in and out of the harbor, which would be probably about a week or so. But then for the rest of the dredging, the barge is able to stay out of the way of all the boaters, and they're able to navigate in and out.
Okay, so there'll only be 1 week of total closure?
Yeah, something like that. It really depends on the contractor and who the contractor is and what their means and methods are going to be, but approximately. They may be able to do it without any obstruction at all.
Well, that would be great news for the boaters.
Yeah, definitely.
How much has been set aside for that?
For the Wailoa dredging project, the cost estimate for it is $2.4 million. There was a bill in the legislature this year to provide a revolving maintenance dredging fund for the Division of Boating and Ocean Recreation. And unfortunately, that didn't pass through. But that would be a really great help for us so that we could plan and budget for these dredging projects so we don't run into these situations where it's a crisis situation for us to be able to do the dredging.
Proactive versus reactive?
Yeah. We would very much support that going through again in the future.
Did you get support from the boating community on that?
Yeah, absolutely. All the boaters who get affected by our dredging projects are definitely in support of it.
But still didn't make it through?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll have to follow up on that. Anything else more on the Kona side?
Kona side doesn't require much dredging. In terms of other projects we have going on there, we do have a project that we're in the permitting phase of right now for our North Kauai Harbor. Back in, it was in 2020, I believe, there was a huge weather event, big wave event that knocked out about 60-foot section of the breakwater. And so we have a project that we're working on right now to repair it and build it back up approximately 4 feet taller so that it can better withstand those future wave events. So that'll be a good project for that harbor.
And when does that get underway?
Well, we're still in the permitting phase right now. So we're hoping to have all of our permits done maybe by the end of this year, and then we'll be ready to go out to bid once we get our permits.
Okay, but it's all really key infrastructure for the boating community.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, all right. So just, I guess, what you're advising them to be just a little patient, wait a little bit longer?
Yeah, we've been in contact with the community that uses the harbor, so they're aware of the process we have to follow. We had to do an environmental assessment, Army Corps permitting, and all that stuff. So
all the red tape. Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, Finn. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks, Catherine.
Okay, thanks so much. Bye-bye.
All right, take care.
That was Finn McCall, engineer with the Division of Boating at the Department of Land and Natural Resources. He was talking about the repairs that are getting underway at the Big Islands Harbors.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and takeout daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
The news and music you hear on HPR are supported in part by local organizations that choose to reinforce their brand with us.
Mahalo to Honolulu Magazine, Jill Fong Piano Studio, and Ma Lama Mauna Lua. They believe, just as you do, in the power of public radio. See a full list of our sponsors at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
The impacts of Hawaii Island's feral cat colonies on the endangered nene population has been a hot topic. After our interview with Jordan Lerma of nene.org last week, we received several emails from listeners. Elaine from Bahoa wrote, "All of the hoopla over nene dying by droves from toxoplasmosis sped by feral cats is misplaced and incorrect. In a study conducted over 22 years of examining 300 dead nene, the most common cause of death was starvation. The second most was trauma, which includes strikes by cars and predation by mongoose, rats, pigs, dogs, and cats. The third is infection, of which toxoplasmosis is the most common, but also includes about 20 other diseases. The public outrage should be directed at DLNR and the Parks Department for not addressing starving geese and stretches of road where most are hit by cars." And Dana from the Big Island echoes those thoughts. She added, "I just drove myself over the Saddle Road to Kona last week, and the slaughter of nene on the road is horrific. Humans, cars, and many other factors are causing the death of nene and many other native Hawaiian species. To target cats when there are solutions for cats that don't involve euthanasia is one-sided. An island-wide education program so own cats and dogs could be fixed would be major. Hawaii lags behind the entire mainland on fixing cats and dogs in a major way. Barriers along Saddle Road would be good, too. Keep the nene and the goats off the roads." Well, today we hear from the group Aloha Animal Oasis. Its goal is to reduce the number of feral cats, and relocating cat colonies away from native bird habitats and coastal areas is part of its mission. The Conversation's Russell Subiano sat down with co-founder John Hopf.
Doing the work that you do, you know, what are your thoughts on how feral cat populations are impacting native endangered species?
I can't speak specifically to, you know, cause of death and scientific impact and what the data, you know, may suggest after, you know, further research into it. But I do know that, you know, the feral cat problem is something that needs to be controlled. There's been some efforts on the island for years. The real only humane way to do it is through spay and neuter, and to try to control the population through cutting off the reproductive cycle. And our organization feels that we just need to ramp up that effort, and it's going to help a lot of things on this island, whether it's nene or it's the coastal areas or just nuisances in backyards. If we can ramp up the spay and neuter numbers up to a level that can start to reverse the growth trend in feral cats, the problem is just going to get better and better over time. So that's been our initiative from the start, is just to try to control the feral cat population in a humane way. And the reality is, most of the cat people that are out there, they don't want the cats being homeless living on the streets any more than anyone else does. They just want to find a humane solution to it all.
Would one of the solutions, or maybe the ideal solution, be something along the lines of the cat sanctuary on Lanai? Would that be something that you think would be beneficial to all parties, whether they were cat lovers or not necessarily fans of the feral cat colonies?
Yes, with our organization, there's two founders. We came together maybe about 2.5 years ago. There was a couple other people involved at the time. And we've noticed that the efforts that are being done on this island right now are not enough to fix the problem. What the other organizations have done have been absolutely amazing. And it's educating on the importance of spay and neuter and doing the work. But we feel that the way to actually solve this is exactly what you said, is to get a cat sanctuary on our island. So we put a business plan together, and primarily it's to be located in a tourist-driven area, because the number one tourist attraction on the island of Lanai is the cat sanctuary, and they're almost exclusively funded by the tourists that come through the doors. And our island has approximately 50 times as many tourists, so we believe that we could bring in enough money that we could have full-time vets on staff that are trained in the high-quality, high-volume spay and neuter surgeries, that we can be doing surgery 7 days a week, 365 days a year, And right now, if I were to guess, it's probably about 4,000 or 5,000 cats are spayed or neutered on our island a year. I think we could ramp that up to 20,000 or 30,000 surgeries in a year, you know, with this type of business model. At the same time, the cats that are impacting, you know, a protected endangered species like the nene or coastal areas where it may be impacting some of the marine species, we can start to take some of those cats in to our sanctuary where they could be enjoyed by tourists and socialize and live a great life. And if there's any other areas that may be at risk near highways, I know there's some buildings that are going to be repurposed here pretty soon on the Hilo side, relocating cats from there, just in at-risk type of areas or areas that are going to impact the native species. We can take those into the sanctuary. We feel like that's a win-win solution that protects everybody and all animals that are involved without causing taxpayer dollars to be impacted.
Do you think this issue of feral cat populations impacting nene populations is being portrayed accurately in the media?
Well, it's being portrayed a lot of different ways in the media, but as far as killing nene, I'm not so sure. I haven't seen it myself. I've heard the most recent situation was because of toxoplasmosis, which I'm not well versed in it, but I have heard that it comes from rats and cats can eat rats. And so the rats could still be the problem, even if the cats were removed. But again, I'm not incredibly well versed in it, in the details of the toxoplasmosis and the way that the cats are potentially impacting the nene. But I think it kind of boils down to this is a human problem that we didn't get our cats spayed and neutered. They were released out into the, you know, when people move or don't want their pet anymore, and they reproduce, and they've gotten to the point that it's become a nuisance, not only to nene and to other things, but it's also up to people to find a humane solution for it. And that's kind of what our organization really is trying to push. We're not trying to turn a blind eye to it. We know that there is some nuisances out there. We just need to find a humane solution that humans caused.
You've shared that you're not up to speed on the exact numbers, you know, in terms of how nene are dying or how their cause of death has been distributed. Some of the feedback that we've gotten implies that toxoplasmosis is actually a small percentage of nene death. Putting all that aside, putting, you know, aside what the numbers might be, maybe you've heard some feedback from people who, you know, may have been misinformed or may have a really extreme view of how the situation would be handled. Maybe if they knew more information, they would understand or have a different opinion. What would you say to them about this particular situation with cats and endangered species on the Big Island?
I think the thing that I would like for those people to know is that even the people that are cat lovers, we understand the situation and we don't want to, you know, cause harm to any other animals. If you have compassion, you spend your own time, your own money to go and take care of these, you know, feral cats. You obviously have compassion for a lot of things. We don't want harm done to anything. And I think that, how do I word this? But deep down, all these cat lovers, we don't want the cats on the street. We don't want these feral cat colonies growing to the level that they are because there's so much pain and suffering and hardships in the wild that we don't want those feral cats any more than the next person. But we just want to treat it humanely. We don't want to just, you know, kill one species to protect another species. Especially because humans caused this problem, we feel like we want to come up with a solution and not just penalize the cats because they were, you know, reproducing. I think that's the biggest thing I'd like to convey is that cat people, we don't want feral cats, but we don't want them treated unfairly and inhumanely.
Thanks for sharing that. That's what cat lovers and people who are upset with the feral cat colonies have in common, is that neither of them want cats to be out in the wild. Cat lovers would rather them being in a more safe and loving environment. That's good. That's some common ground. I feel like that could be a good start to communities working together to find a different solution.
For sure.
Yeah.
One other thing to add to that is people that go and feed these feral cats, if all they're doing is feeding the cats, they're being irresponsible, in my opinion. If you're going to go and you're going to take and start feeding, you know, cat colonies and start taking care of them, you have to take that next step. And to trap them, get them spayed or neutered, and put them back where you found them. That's the best way to control this population, is to limit the amount of cats that are reproducing out there. If you're just feeding them, you're just perpetuating the problem and you're just making it worse. So I think it's very important, if you want to feed cats, that's fantastic, but take the next step, reach out to several organizations on this island that are doing free or low-cost spay or neuter surgeries, and get those cats trapped. Most of these organizations will lend out the traps to get them spayed or neutered so we can control the population. That's responsible colony management.
John Hopf, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for your time, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
That was Aloha Animal Oasis co-founder John Hopf talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. If you're interested in learning more about their efforts to humanely reduce feral cat colonies, we'll have a link to more information on our website later today. This happens to be Teacher Appreciation Month, so we thought it fitting to hear from Big Island teacher Rory Inouye. Mr. Inouye won the Milken Award this year for his work at Waikea High School, along with Jade Fan, a teacher at Kamananakoa Middle School. We caught up with Mr. Inouye earlier this week.
So both of my parents are teachers. My dad was a high school teacher, started at Pahoa High and Intermediate, and my mom is a preschool teacher at Kamehameha Preschool. They're both retired now, but just being around them, the influence they made on their students, I think that's just kind of where me being a teacher originated. I wasn't the best math student in high school. And for me, I just thought about it as lines on a paper. And so when I really thought about what math is and how I can relate math to other students, you know, I wanted to make math different and take math more than just lines on a paper. So that's kind of where I aspired to become a math teacher.
And I read that you draw from math podcasts. I didn't even know those existed. I didn't know that.
Yeah. You know, us math teachers have a close-knit podcast, things like that, just to kind of get ideas. And, you know, like when I'm working out in the mornings, kind of just thinking about different ways I can approach things and make math different for students.
Well, I understand that you also played baseball and also coached your high school athletes. And I think coaching can just do so much to inspire the kids to push themselves.
Yeah. You know, it's nice to see the students outside of the classroom, right? When they're in the classroom and it's about schooling and grades and learning math. And I get to see a totally different side of them on the baseball field, on, you know, even the students who come to support the players, you know, just to see them outside of the classroom is a whole different aspect of knowing the student, especially in high school, you know, because they're young adults, they're you can see their personality developing, you know. So when I was coaching baseball, it was just a great way to get to know students beyond the classroom and a different way to inspire them. I want to give back to my high school, and I'm not 100% sure on what that looks like yet. But I want to help develop or inspire more high schoolers to be teachers. So Waikea High School is an academy school, which means our seniors get to do internships. The students get a look into careers they're interested in. So we have about 10 or 12 students who are interested in teaching as their pathway. And, you know, I'm trying to figure out a way, like maybe a scholarship or something for the students who are pursuing teaching, just to kind of give inspiration and give, you know, encourage them to keep on going towards teaching, because we need more teachers.
Yes, we do. And as we honor our teachers this month, who were your, say, high school teachers that may have helped you?
When I was a student here, because I went to Waikea High School, and I had a math teacher named Gordon Mao. He's retired now, but he was also my baseball coach. So I came back to the high school. I became the baseball coach. I'm teaching math. I'm in his old classroom, you know. So Gordon Mao has definitely been somebody who has helped me along the way and kind of made me the person I am today, you know. But to tell you a really cool story, after my Milken Award announcement, my fourth grade teacher reached out to me and had pictures of me in fourth grade. And she wrote me a card, told me how proud she was of me, gave me my fourth grade pictures. And it's just moments like that, you know, like a teacher can, even after you had them 20 years later, 30 years later, still give you goosebumps.
That's amazing, you know, that you can make those connections or, you know, early on. You mentioned that Waikea is an academy. I know that has become such an amazing magnet for students who if you're put in a nurturing environment, can just excel.
So we have, I'm a part of the Freshman Academy, so I get all the incoming freshmen, and it's just kind of introductory to the school. And then from there, they can go to the Arts and Communication Academy, Academy of Industry and Technology, so that's our construction, engineering, automotive. We have our Public Services Academy, so that's where our teachers are, psychologists, things like that. And then we have our Health Academy. You know, and it's awesome because from sophomore, junior year, they get to dive into their profession. And senior year, we try to line them up with some sort of hands-on or some sort of internship. And for some kids, they love it. And for other kids, it's a reality check of like, oh, I thought I was interested in this, but maybe I'm not. Maybe I want to pursue something else. But at least they know early on. Then, you know, especially with college being so expensive now, we would hate the students to go 2-3 years into college and then realize this is not what I'm interested in. You know, I'm lucky because I have great coworkers. I co-teach with Mr. Silva. Clifton Silva has been my co-teacher for 10 years. So we pretty much see each other more than our families. And we do full inclusion. So we have special education and regular education students in our class. We get them in ninth grade. And it's just a blast, you know, coming to work, having good coworkers. It makes it fun. My administration, my principal, they're amazing. So, you know, it's just being in the right environment, I guess, has definitely helped, right? And just being appreciative that I guess I'm being recognized for awesome things I'm doing, but just trying to see, like, what else can I do to help our kids of Hilo, of Hawaii, give back to my school, Waikia High School.
Well, you know, when we interviewed that principal, Mr. Cox, his parents were educators as well. And so, yeah, I mean, your parents must have been over the moon when you got that award.
My dad's five words he said was, "What? What? Joking?"
Oh, gosh, yeah. Well, I guess they say what? The apple doesn't fall far from the tree, right?
I guess so.
Yeah. Well, that's the best gift you could give your parents, right? I mean, excelling in something that they nurtured long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else?
Yeah, it's an amazing ride, and I'm still trying to navigate this award. You know, I have a LA trip coming up in June where I'll meet the other Milken awardees from this year. Jade Pham is the other Milken educator from Hawaii. She's been amazing. She's so on it, like. Anytime I have a question, she knows the answer. So, you know, I'm excited. I've gotten to meet amazing educators in Hawaii through this program. And, you know, and that's all that. Just keep learning from them and keep trying to get better.
You know, we also connected with some of Mr. Inouye's students to ask them what they thought makes a good teacher. Freshman Jaina Aguar says when the school called for a mystery assembly last month, she said she knew in her heart it was to honor Mr. Rory Inouye. She says he is truly humble and really cares that his students get it.
Mr. Inouye cares a lot about his students' learning capability and takes that into consideration when he does things like make his lessons and his work. Mr. Inouye cares a lot more about students individually. And he wants to make sure he helps every single student.
You can see that in what he does every day?
Yes. We always like to tell jokes in class, and the class is just a really fun environment.
And what is it about math that you enjoy?
I like that there can be an infinite amount of answers.
Ah, that makes it, I guess, challenging, huh?
Yeah, but I like challenging.
And Waiakea High School junior Boston Kaneshiro told us, he's a bit of a math nerd. He just loves formulas. He thinks he may study engineering or finance in college. Here's what he thinks makes a good teacher and why Mr. Inouye is a good role model.
A good teacher is someone who cares about all of their students, not just have their favorites. And they're really dedicated about what they teach, and they're really passionate about it. And they have a good background in what they teach, and they really enjoy like coming to school and helping their students every day.
And so what did you think when you heard about Mr. Inouye getting this award?
When I first heard, we were all in a gym with like the whole school there. And I was like, oh, wow. I was really surprised. I was really happy for him too. Like, he works really hard and he's a great guy. So he definitely deserves to be recognized.
You have seen him in action. What is it that maybe sets him apart when he tries to get, you know, students excited about math?
Well, I like that he has us work in groups, like with each other, because math can be a little challenging sometimes and really difficult and frustrating. But he tries to make the classes fun by introducing, like, fun projects to do. Like, this quarter, we recently had a magnet project where we could, like, design anything we wanted on Desmos, which is a graphing software. So it kind of was fun. Like, we're doing math and having fun at the same time. It's really an honor, like, having to be taught math from, like, one of the top, at one of the best schools in the state is really an honor.
And senior Marley Mason graduates tomorrow. She is headed off to Boston to attend Northeastern University. She plans to study politics, philosophy, and economics. She jokes that what Mr. Inouye has taught her will help her tolerate her college math classes.
I think that a good teacher is someone who is really like passionate about the subject that they're teaching and really wants to see students succeed and doesn't just do it for the paycheck or the prestige, more is doing it to serve others and to be a bright light in their community and help kids with their future.
And so would you say Mr. Inouye checks all the boxes there?
I definitely would say that knowing everything about him and knowing that like he's from a family of educators also, I can tell that he really is passionate about it and he really does want us as students to succeed, and he does everything he can to help us do so.
So what does he do to make it interesting for you in the classroom?
I think I really like his approach of having groups do like problems at the whiteboard, because it helps us all kind of break out of our shells a little bit, because especially since I'm in like an honors math class, so a lot of people can be a little bit scared to like ask for help. So I think that having us do groups like that really does force us to connect with our peers and ask each other for help and clarifying questions and all this kind of stuff.
Anything else you want to say about Mr. Inouye or to say to him?
Thank you for helping me survive my senior year. Even though your class was really hard, I think that it's really going to help me in the future in college. So thank you so much. And this is a pool.
And there you have it from your toughest critics. Good job, Mr. Rory Inouye. Congratulations. Your school community appreciates all you do. And please enjoy your trip to Disneyland with your family. And that's it for this Aloha Friday. A big mahalo to Hilo Medical Center for hosting us today. Our program is produced by Russell Subiono, Lillian Song, Maddie Bender, and Savannah Harriman-Pote. Find the Conversation podcast on our website or on Spotify, Apple, or Google. Our backyard quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. And on that note, we say goodbye from the Big Island. We will be off for the Memorial Day holiday, but back again on Tuesday. Join us then. Pick up the conversation.